This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's John Dalton Banks Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see johncast.net.
Hi, everyone. This is Liz. I'm here with Jerónimo Bernard Salas. He's from the Astrophysics Institute of Space in Paris. He gave the talk, the colloquium, this week in John Dalton Banks. And his talk was about circumstellar and interstellar fullerenes. Thank you for being with us in the podcast, Jerónimo.
My pleasure.
Thanks. So let's start from the beginning. Tell us a little bit about fullerenes. What are they, and how did you observe them, or what happened?
Well, fullerenes is basically it's a large molecule made of carbon in the form of a ball, basically. It's any molecule in the shape of a hollow structure, so like a sphere or ellipsoid. And the most popular one is actually the one that has 60 carbon atoms, mm-hmm. which has the exact shape of a typical soccer ball. So it has mm-hmm. 12 pentagons and 20 hexagons, and you put a carbon molecule in the junctures, and you have a C60, basically.
Okay.
A buckyball is called.
Yeah, okay.
And, they were basically predicted to be seen in space. They were first discovered in the laboratory experiments here on Earth that were aiming to understand the formation of carbon dust in carbon stars, basically. And they discovered all these fullerenes, and these fullerenes are very sturdy, so it was predicted that they could survive the harsh condition of the interstellar medium, and therefore they could be observed in space. Mm-hmm. And there were, however, many searches for them, but they were unsuccessful, so it took 25 years, and we finally discovered it in basically a young planetary nebulae, which is basically is the last phase of evolution of a star like the Sun, basically, and we have discovered them there.
Right, so about these fullerenes, do they have applications? I mean, can you use them for anything here on Earth?
Well, yes, that's why they have attracted so much attention, actually.
Yeah.
These fullerenes is because they have many, many applications. They have remarkable both physical and chemical properties, and with many technological applications. For instance, in the field of nanotechnology, they are important because they reach superconductivity around 18 Kelvin, which is rather high, so that's good. They also, in material science, they are important because of their conductivity, basically to replace the silicon market, right?
Okay.
All these computers and stuff, like silicon is relatively, let's say, expensive and heavy. Mm-hmm. So, of course, other options is to use polymers, so some plastic, basically, which is light and cheap, right, to produce. And you just include some organic material, right, to promote electron transfer. That's it.
Right.
And, of course, use fullerenes, nanotubes, so they are very important for that. And they have even been used for medicine, basically, for target drug delivery. They can basically attach some chemicals to the fullerenes that they can go to certain parts of your body and be released there. So they've been... Apparently, they've been used for treating cancer and melanoma.
Wow.
And even these molecules are very, very sturdy, very resistant. And there have been experiments where they call it a bucky bottle. So you have the sphere, and they can open it, and they can, for instance, include a molecule of water in it and close it.
Oh,
and,
wow.
You know, like that, you have a molecule of water inside the fullerenes, which can be delivered in other parts, you know, of wherever, which is interesting because this... Basically, fullerene is protecting this water molecule there.
Wow, that's really interesting. So you mentioned circumstellar and interstellar. So these fullerenes have been observed in different objects.
That's correct. So we first discovered it in these last phases of stellar evolution of mm-hmm. stars like the Sun. But following our discovery, now fullerenes have been discovered in many, many other environments. So also, of course, circumstellar, like post-AGV phase or AGV phases, but also interstellars, as you say, like reflection nebula or star-forming regions, for instance, even in stars and also in young stellar objects, basically stars that just been formed, which is very interesting, right? It could mean that you can deliver also fullerenes to planetary systems, for instance.
Yeah, which is pretty amazing. There are bookie balls everywhere. There.
Yes.
Everyone is playing football. So did you, about like formation of the fullerenes, do you need them to be like a very dense environment, or can it be, I mean, because all these regions tend to be pretty dense at some points, actually the interstellar medium is quite not very dense, I guess.
But. Exactly. So Basically, there have been many formation mechanisms that have been proposed, or how you can form them also here on Earth. Mm-hmm. But we have shown that many of these do not work in space, actually,
okay.
For several reasons. For instance, where they were discovered here on Earth, it was laboratory experiments in hydrogen-poor environments.
Okay.
Now in space, we have a lot of hydrogen.
Yeah.
So, you know, even though, of course, you can form them like that, in space, we need some other mechanism to think of.
Yeah.
You can form them, they say, with high temperature, also formation like combustion, because then the problem is that if you attach hydrogen to the edges, then you don't form fullerenes, you form PAHs, something else, a different molecule.
Okay.
Unfortunately, it seems that in these laboratory experiments, either you form one or the other, fullerenes or these PAHs, but not both. And in space, we observe both.
Right.
Then there is experiments laboratory where you can form them by ablating PAHs and graphene. But this is difficult because you can do it in here on Earth, but you need specific conditions. You need to start from a molecule of about, say, 70 carbon atoms, things like this. But in space, it's very difficult to tune all these parameters, right?
Of course.
So we see that these ones do not really work also, and also because of time constraints.
Okay.
For instance, the one where you require a high temperature to form them, to get those temperatures in the interstellar medium, you might need a shock gas, for instance, but the post-density shock is very low.
Yeah.
So you require a lot of time to form them, more than the lifetime of these objects.
Okay.
So we need the different mechanisms. There's another one that is called photochemical processing of HACS, but basically it's a combination, it's a mixture of many different materials, which, like, you have hexagonal rings, like you would, you know, like benzene rings, they're
uh-huh.
called, and also carbon chains, and this could be curled up, and this could be a viable mechanism, we find, but clearly it needs more work.
So, for the evolution of these molecules, is it like you form them in these regions, or do you think they been chilled, and then they, I don't know, like you form them in a young stellar object, and then in these regions around it travels through the ISM, and then it goes to the planetary nebula or something?
This is an interesting question, but maybe it's the other way around. We know that in the last phases, like a planetary nebula, in the last phases of evolution of the stars from the AGV to the planetary nebulae, we know that it's you have a very rich and very complex chemistry. You form a lot of molecules, many of them. And this is where we found the fullerenes, and we have found evidence of fullerenes being formed there in many objects. So
mm-hmm.
clearly they are formed there.
Okay.
Now, we have also find them in the interstellar medium or in young stellar objects. They are there as well. They have been found. So the idea is, okay, do we form them in this planetary nebulae, in this AGV planetary nebulae phase, and then they survive, and then we see them in the interstellar medium?
Yeah.
That will be one. Or also in young stellar objects, or you somehow destroy them, because even though they are very stable, they are very sturdy, you could imagine that, you know, the interstellar medium is a harsh environment, right?
Yeah.
So you get hit by cosmic rays, all kind of things.
Yeah.
So eventually you might be able to destroy them. This is something that we need to calculate, actually, how long they survive.
Right.
If you destroy them, that means that the fullerenes that are seen in this interstellar medium, in these stars, young stellar objects, they must have been reformed somehow.
Yeah. Okay.
And this might require different conditions. So we don't know the answer to that yet, but clearly it's something very important that we need to look at.
That's really interesting. I was thinking while you were talking, have they been observing supernova remnants? Or
No.
Okay.
They haven't been observed yet there, no.
Do you expect them to be there? Or
It was expected to be seen in the carbon-rich grain condensation sequence, known to occur in some kind of supernova type 2, and... But they have not yet been observed. No.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah, the other important thing is how to observe them, right? Like you observe them in the infrared.
That's correct.
What was the telescope that you were using?
We're using the Spitzer Space Telescope.
Okay.
And we use the infrared spectrograph in that telescope to observe them. Because fullerenes, they have a lot of, for instance, the C60, which is the most stable molecule, the one we see more. They have many vibrational modes, many of them, but because they are so symmetric, right? even if you move them, they don't change a lot the dipole moment. So basically, they only have four infrared bands, and they're all in the infrared. So you need the infrared telescope to observe them.
Okay. Now, it's the only wavelength that you could.
Well, let's say there might be electronic bands that could be expected in the for instance in the optical also of ionized fullerenes, for instance. So okay. There are other places we could look at as well.
Okay.
In the optical.
So, and what are the excitation processes then? Is it just rotation and vibration and you get the photons that come out, or do you have to hit them with, like, I don't know, fluorescence or?
So there are several excitation mechanisms that have been proposed, and I can already tell you that there's still not clear consensus on which one
okay.
prevails. We're studying this. One is basically thermal excitation, the other is fluorescence. It's difficult actually to tell, simply because even though these two processes predict different band intensities, right? For mm-hmm. instance, the fullerene bands, the C60, they have four infrared bands. So you could play basically with the relative intensity of these bands to mm-hmm. see what this one model predicts, what the other predicts. Now, unfortunately, in reality, the problem we have is that many of these bands, you have fullerenes, but you have also other materials. Some of them are blended, so it's difficult to just isolate them to get, you know, the absolute relative strength. Also, there seems to be some issues with the laboratory measurements because different groups give also different relative strengths of the bands.
Okay.
So that makes it a bit difficult.
Yeah.
On the other hand, we seem to have found that in the first object where we found it, it's kind of extended. We can get some special distribution. We can know a bit where the fullerenes are emitting.
Okay.
And we find them like 8,000 astronomical units from the star that is ionizing them. And this seems to be basically, is that they are far away. So it's difficult to understand them in terms of thermal excitation now, because if they are thermal, what we were proposing is that maybe they need to be in contact, because the temperature we measure is a bit colder. You need mm-hmm. to, they should be in contact with some colder material. We propose maybe they are with carbonaceous grains, that they must be abundant. Those are in radiative equilibrium with the central star.
Yeah.
So basically their temperature is determined by the distance to
yeah.
the central star. Now, that far out, we would expect them to be much colder than what we measure.
Okay.
So that seems to go against basically thermal excitation. So we might be now be favoring the fluorescence.
And the last question I wanted to ask you, well, have there been discovered in extragalactic sources, and do you think we should look for them?
We should definitely look for them. They have been discovered in more planetary nebulae, in the large Magellanic Cloud and the small Magellanic Cloud. So there is already extragalactic detections of these
yes.
objects. What will be very interesting, of course, is if you can detect them. When you look at galaxies far away, all the information is mixed, right? All this integrated in one. You don't have a special information. So they might get lost, you know, their emission with the emission of others. Parts of the galaxy or there, but it will be very interesting if they would be seen there, because that will mean they are very abundant. And now, that said, new facilities, right, they are having enhanced spatial distribution and also improved sensitivities, right, so we are going to be able to prove even weaker things and farther away. So like with the advent of the James Webb Space Telescope in a few years' times, in 5 years' times, this is going to be something very interesting to look for, actually.
Okay, well, thank you very much for the interview.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Bye.